Let the drama kick, the drama kick die. Let the drama kick, let the drama kick die. Let the drama kick, let the drama kick die. Let the drama kick, 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 the drama kick die.
This is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. And I must warn you, or I don't know, I must warn you, but it's not scary, that this is a special episode with sneak peeks at the upcoming Bushwick Book Club creatives. Sprinkled throughout this show, you will hear from some people who are creating something for the Bushwick Book Club, from the book How to Make White People Laugh by Negin Farsad. I don't know how to pronounce her name.
It's okay. I feel like that would be something in her book.
Yeah, she made a comment about white people not being able to pronounce things. But that's fair. I'm just reinforcing the stereotype. Oh, wait.
Yeah, we saw her speak at Book Riot this past fall.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's talk about that. I'm also curious because in the clips, a couple people mentioned that they are digesting the book via audiobook. And I'm curious if she's the narrator, because I must tell you, she's a character. And she has a very distinctive voice and a very, like, loud clothing and persona presence, and is just commands your attention in a really nice way.
Yeah.
And she makes you laugh.
Yeah, she definitely stuck out in a good way at Book Riot.
And she was a last minute ad, so that was, like, a surprise. I guess maybe some people were upset, but I was just there to enjoy Yeah. She was on a panel. I'm trying to recall what her panel was about. I think it was about something to the effect of literary diversity and representing a population.
That sounds right.
As a result of being one of a very small handful of people from that population who has written a book. So in her case, Iranian American. I had to think about it because I didn't want to say Iranian. Yeah. And there it is again.
It's okay. All is forgiven.
Anyways, and then so as we're hearing from creatives kind of mid-process or procrastinating their process, as you will hear, I thought it would be a fun show to talk about process and to talk about, obviously, I don't know, maybe not obviously. I feel like there's always more ideas than will ever be actualized. And so it's the challenge of picking the right ideas and then just like, I'm maybe not finishing every project. I don't know if that's the thing, but just being able to know which ones to finish and how to actually finish something. So that's our theme. Thanks for listening. And please let us know if you have any questions, comments, criticisms.
Hopefully none of the last one.
There's probably not anything to say.
Yeah, it's a perfect show.
Critical. I think we're pretty much encapsulated as a whole living organism. So I was thinking about this, and I think that a lot of times, well, I have a few thoughts bouncing around, but a lot of times any creative project is kind of given the equivalent of a child. It's like it's conceived, it gestates, it's born, and then it like goes off and lives its happy life. Have you ever heard that comparison?
I don't think so.
Not as explicitly. Okay. Yeah. Maybe we just run in different artistic circles.
I mean, I don't really run in any artistic circles. So.
Well, that's your problem. So, anyways.
I'm an outcast.
Okay, so what for? Well, Chris is a filmmaker, and outside the context of education, you've made a couple other projects. So I was hoping you could tell us what that process was like from like the beginning to like being like, okay, it's now done.
I don't know if I want to spill my trade secrets.
Nobody's listening.
Oh, okay.
It's just me and Drishti. Drishti's got her laptop out. She's typing. Yeah. Frantically.
Typical.
She's our dog, by the way.
Yeah, she showed up occasionally in shows. I mean, as far as, you want me to start from like coming up with an idea or have an idea already and take it through there?
Yeah, I think it's a process of both, of coming up with ideas or knowing which ideas you have to like spend some time developing.
Yeah. I mean, coming up with ideas, I don't know, at least as outside of work, it's probably, I wouldn't say there's a process to at least that bit of it. Just things come into my mind for whatever reason. But then from there, I guess like once I have an idea, trying to think about, I mean, the big thing with making films is whether it's practical, especially if you're
if you don't have major budgets.
Yeah, you don't have a major budget and you don't you just don't have much in the way of any kind of resources. So yeah, that's the easiest one in some sense. You're like, all right, is this practical? Like, nope. All right, well, that one's out the window.
Can you do it? Nope. Okay. Well, it was a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, some would make the argument that you should make it even if you can't really make it.
Just make it shitty.
Yeah. People definitely do that. But that's not really, I'm a little too practical for that. For better or worse.
Okay. So you have an idea. you can make it, then what?
Then a lot of times I'll kind of tool around with what the visuals might be, just since obviously filmmaking is a visual medium. And a lot of people will, you know, actually like storyboard it out.
Mm-hmm.
I do that, but basically just in my head. I don't know. Sometimes it's nice to write things out, but I'm pretty content to just kind of sit there and think through the film and what might work and what might not. And yeah, just visualize.
You take notes during this process, or you keep it all?
It depends. Sometimes I take notes. Yeah, sometimes not. I mean, like there's a film I made that was about 10 minutes long, and I wrote, I think, about like 6 sentences worth of notes. Everything else is just
very elaborate.
Yeah, but it's like worked out in my head, so it's not just winging it. Mm-hmm. I don't know, for whatever reason, I don't have a strong need to write it out. My brain's pretty ordered, so I guess that works.
There you go. And then with filmmaking, it's a little different because you're recruiting people, probably working with their schedules, maybe trying to find props and settings. So when you are like mid-process, what does that look like? And is there ever a point where you abandon or consider abandoning the project now that it's like partially done but not like easy?
I mean, it's never easy. You kind of have, I mean, that sort of comes with filmmaking. If you're making easy films, you're probably making the wrong kind of films. You're not really putting your heart into it. So, but I would say to some extent, those problems you're talking about, I tend to have already canceled out by just being really practical about what ideas might work.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, so usually as a result of that, like the ideas that I'm working with are pliable enough that they work well with the changes that come with no budget films, like people dropping out of the cast, and things like that. So yeah, I mean, once I start filming, it's pretty rare for me to not finish a project just because I'll change it to make it work with the realities of the situation.
Okay. And then post-editing is just like a matter of getting it done?
Yeah. I mean, at least as when it comes to fiction, editing for me feels really straightforward because I don't really shoot extra scenes or extra shots. Like, I know what I want, and so that's the only thing I shoot. And so then when I go to edit, it's really easy to put together because I'm like, yep, A fits in the B, which is fits in the C, and so on. It's a little harder if it's something nonfiction. Like most documentarians will tell you that those films come together in the editing room. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, you don't, if you're working on something nonfiction, you don't necessarily know what,
just gathering as much as you can.
Yeah.
In some senses.
Yeah. And you might have an idea of possible stories, and so you might be working around that. But yeah, if you're not, you're probably not 100% clear. So I'm going to give one example. Like, I made a little film about sea cucumbers, and I had done some research beforehand, so I knew going in kind of maybe what I wanted to highlight about sea cucumbers, but still wasn't clear to me what the shape of the film was going to be until I started editing it.
I think it sounds like your approach is very much matches your personality. So, yeah.
Talking with Casey Holford.
This is Casey Holford, and I'm sitting here in my new apartment with a whole bunch of boxes and stuff. I'm on page nothing of the book, page zero or page negative something. I haven't started it yet. And a couple of weeks out, that's not particularly unusual for me as far as Bushwick Book Club goes. I usually kind of leave it until not the 11th hour, but maybe 10:30 or 10:45, because that's just been my tradition so far, except for stuff that I've already read, which sometimes happens. But new books, I usually kind of devour them quickly and think of whatever my song is going to be quickly. So I'm not worried about this one either, because it is tradition. But I will leave you with a little piece of musical idea that I just thought of, which most likely will not have anything to do with the Bushwick Book Club.
Process with Jesse Kilgus.
This is Jesse Kilgus. I'm currently on page 58 in the book, and I haven't started writing the song yet, just because, you know, I'm a busy person, but I will get around to it soon. What I have been doing is underlining sections that I like. I often do this for book club, and actually whenever I'm just reading a book anyway, I underline things that I like, and then I'll go back and look them over and cobble together some sort of song from those ideas. I'm enjoying the book, and I thought I would read to you a section that I like. It's where she's talking about growing up in Palm Springs, California. Okay, here we go. I was also the only kid on a solid, hardcore block of senior citizens. That block was then surrounded by an even larger neighborhood of senior citizens. My childhood involved a lot of playing in the streets by myself, and then biking in those same streets alone. And let's not forget those times I spent choreographing full-scale dance routines in the street while dodging oncoming Cadillacs. Very slow-moving Cadillacs. Of course, those were solo dance routines because there were no other kids in my neighborhood because there were only senior citizens. I thought that was a funny bit.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I will talk about my process, and I might start monologuing, so you have to stop and ask questions if you have them. Oh. Otherwise, I'll just keep going.
What if it's so fascinating? I don't want to interrupt.
So, for me, I haven't published anything. So, I have been putting things out, which is new for me and very scary and vulnerable. And it's something that is part of my process right now of trying to figure out why that's so hard for me, and also to keep sending things out into the world, even though it's really kind of traumatizing. I just this morning was like, you know, even if it's crap, I just have to keep sending it out. I guess that's like, you know, I don't have a lot of drive to be like a published author or have a book or have like a regular newsletter, but I also, I don't know, I guess that's how you become a writer that actually gets paid to write things. So I'm trying that process, I guess you could say.
Yeah, for better or worse, if you want to get paid, you need to
something that I'm doing beyond just like for myself to hide in these boxes that end up moving with me from place to place, then eventually you have to start sending things out into the world. So that being said, deadlines and accountability. So taking classes is helpful for me because that gives me those things, because I have to show up with something because other people in the class are expecting it. And also it gives me a little bit of structure. It's sometimes a little daunting to sit in front of a blank page or a blank computer document and then be like, okay, now what?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for having some structure. Even doesn't have to be like super strict, but even just having just a framework. And so like being like, okay, like today you have to write a story about, you know, your childhood, then like already, instead of having your brain wander all over the place,
you have a place to start.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes having a place to start makes it much less overwhelming. I lost something in my brain. My brain does not just hold on to things in a logical manner. It's like butterflies and you're like, whoa, wait, where'd it go? I saw it. It was just there. Oh, it's coming back slowly. Oh, writing groups. So having a community of people either that you meet in person or you're in connection digitally with email, but having a group of people that you are kind of sending out some feelers, showing new work is really helpful, because I think especially as a writer, it's really easy to get stuck in your own head about what something is or isn't, and then you wrote it, so you don't see it clearly or experience it clearly. So having someone that you can like be like, here's something I'm working on, can you, I don't know. And it's hard to be vulnerable. You have to pick your people carefully, because some people are going to shoot down your dreams because they're wounded about their own shot dreams.
Yeah, it's have you found there's a difference as far as working with a community that's in the flesh versus online?
I prefer in flesh, but I also use it as an excuse to stop writing if circumstances change, for example, moving.
Yeah.
So I think that having people that you can email and still keep in touch with is just as important, not putting all your eggs in one basket, I guess. And I guess it also depends on the structure of a group, you know, what that looks like. If you're meeting every week, if you're meeting once a month, how organized it is, you know, does everyone read their work, or are you focusing on one person's work? There's a lot of different ways that that can work. And you know, you got to find what's getting you to be productive as a writer. And then I would also say, if you do have a little bit of a portfolio or body of work, that there are quite a number of retreats and residencies that cater to writers, and some that cater to writers that aren't published, to help them, you know, find their first book or whatever. So if you're in a place where you have, you know, work to show what you're doing and kind of a pitch, an elevator pitch for what you envision doing, you can totally check out retreats and residencies. Some are paid or not paid. Some are free. Some are you pay to go, but you gotta, again, find something that fits your situation. And getting away from it all, for a lot of writers, I feel like that's, at some point, it's a critical part of their process.
So some of those residencies aren't quite getting away from it all. Like the recent one with Mall of America establishing a writer's residency.
Yeah, that's for extrovert writers. And I mean, a lot of writers really love writing in coffee shops. You know, I had a friend, actually my mentor, Faceboy, he carried a notebook and a pen with him everywhere and kind of forced himself to write anywhere and anywhere, so that was never the excuse, that he was like, oh, but I'm not at my desk with my special pen and my special notebook with my like certain candle. Like, it was like, I'm gonna write here, and now I'm gonna write here, and now I'm gonna write here, which I thought was an interesting approach. I mean, definitely as a writer, I think it's critical to carry around a notebook, and not, I don't like phones. There's too much distraction on phones. Anyway, so and then this is more for creative projects in general, but planning that things are going to take way more time than you think they're going to take.
Always.
Always. You're like, oh yeah, I can write that intro in 15 minutes and then edit it tomorrow. And no. And it doesn't happen. So that being said, I did a quick search on project management. And this is for like construction projects and other things, but I thought maybe it'd be fun and funny to see what carryover there was. So project managing starts with initiation. So that's like the idea, deciding on the idea, and then planning. But I thought it was interesting because they break that down in a bunch of categories that may or may not be progressive, but scope, so like a scale, working out a schedule, figuring out resources and budgeting, deciding quality, communication, like all this, I think, risk management and implementation. So that's like a very official approach. But if you think about it, I think even writing projects and certainly, you know, paintings or films include a lot of those aspects. So I think breaking it down into the tasks or the steps really makes it much more likely to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that list, I mean, perfectly fits any filmmaking project.
Yeah.
Or any like properly made film.
And then completion and celebration.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the irony of creative work is people think that there's the appearance of freedom and flow because it's not sitting at a desk from 9 to 5, like typing Excel spreadsheets or whatnot. But like really,
that's part of it.
Yeah, to a large extent, successful creative work. And I'm not like, defining success necessarily as like making money or whatnot, but just like creating work, whatever your medium is, like does require structure.
Does it does.
Bushwick Book Club check-in with Gia Jung.
Hi, I'm Gia Jung, and I suppose I only consider myself a songwriter when I'm doing something with the Bushwick Book Club, or rather when they're letting me have the honor of joining in. And the page of the book I'm on, I'm actually finished with Nagin Farsad's How to Make White People Laugh. So if we make sort of an anatomical or biological analogy of what stage my eventual song is in, I would say it's at the stage where the parents of what will be an embryo and then a child and then a fully developed person are meeting at a blind date, and they're taking seats at the table awkwardly, and they're not sure if they are attracted to each other even. What I'm trying to say is, in all honesty, I'm not sure how I feel about this book, its implications. Everything's so loaded for me, you know, because I'm not white. Or no, it's just, but I did find some pieces in there that I definitely think I can go on, that I must go on once I stop procrastinating. And I'm enjoying the process and looking forward to writing something that will either make white people laugh also, or maybe do exactly the opposite. Just kidding.
Talking to Jim Andralis.
Hello, this is Jim Andralis. I'm a songwriter and a singer, and I'm also a therapist, psychotherapist. I'm listening to the audiobook, so I have 4 hours and 56 minutes remaining. Ideas sloshing around in my head. None of them do I like. I find myself not really allowing myself to sink into comedy. I'm finding myself sinking into despair and rage and terror. I think I might go a little dark, and then I'm having some concerns that may not be, actually, not really. I know you guys could do dark, but still, it's like funny, 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 and then me. But it just might be that way. Am I procrastinating? Yes, I am. What does my procrastination sound like? It really sounds like me not wanting to listen to the book. It's very quiet. One of the ideas that I have is like, I think there was like a New Yorker magazine cover where right after 9/11, it was like this man driving a cab with a million American flags all over it just so he wouldn't get hurt. And I'm just thinking about how dangerous, you know, like when you have to make someone laugh because your life depends on it. I'm just thinking about that dynamic. And I'm also thinking of embodying, you know, I'm a white person, that, and, you know, some sort of perpetratory song. I think I'm going to do like a perpetrator song, which is fucked up. Feelings, are you enjoying this? You know, I'm up for a challenge. Sure. Am I experiencing emotions? Always. What is the emotional spectrum of songwriting creating for book club? I love it. There's like a thing that emerges of themes, and not just themes about the book, but themes about the people there. And I can't wait. I love that stuff. And I love contributing to it too. So that's me. All right. Bye.
Again, so great. I love hearing people talk about their process. I'm like a process junkie. If you're just tuning in, this is Radio Free Brooklyn. You are listening to Ink and Worm, and this is a fun special on project completion and the BBC sneak peek for April's Bushwick Book Club. Two things I was holding on to is, so I opened the show talking about how a lot of people give like a life cycle to projects, which is very like accurate. There's like steps and things get aborted and whatnot. But I love Elizabeth Gilbert in her book, Big Magic. She's like, your book is not a human being. You know, she talks about how there's this like pretense of you must suffer to bring this thing into being. And then you must like send it out into the world. Like you're putting your kid on school for the first, like on the bus for the first day of school. And she's like, stop doing that. It makes the process harder than it needs to be. That was funny.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and to me, like, again, I'm very practical. That like seems so melodramatic.
It is melodramatic. Like,
stop wasting your time bitching about suffering for your work and just
It's like a thing in writing where they're like, kill your darlings, you know, edit until it's whatever. Or I'm trying to think of other examples, but like a very violent interaction with this precious thing.
Bah. That's what I say.
Back.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I take pride in when I'm putting my work in, and because I know it's like going towards something.
Yeah. Well, and then I was going to say also, if you don't have access to a community of people, either digitally or in person, you could always just like have a party. So you send out invitations to all your friends and be like, we're going to celebrate this thing on this day. And then that means suddenly you have to be done with that thing by that day. So that's kind of what the Bushwick Book Club does. It's like, we're going to all do this thing on this day. So make sure you have something.
Yeah, no, I really like the format of Bushwick Book Club, and it definitely produces an interesting range of work.
Some great stuff. Well, I think it's a matter of preference too, because somebody's jam might not be your jam.
Yeah, but then the next one might be.
And then you're like, what? He's playing a harp? He's my favorite.
So good.
So good. How are we on time? Yeah, it's always a toss-up of what you're walking into. Never know what to expect. And usually there's not a dull moment. Sometimes there's like moving mics.
There's occasional dull moment.
There's moving mics and equipment, especially for my pieces where there's like, oh, move this thing. Oh, my music isn't plugged in. Oh, it's worth it. The anticipation just makes everyone all excited.
Exactly.
Or everyone gets to refill their drinks. So I also, we did a river riding this week.
Zing. Yeah.
So I'll read the poem. I think we'll have a couple more clips after we do that. Our poem this week is short and strange, and I like it. It's called The Map, and it is by Marie Howe. The failure of love might account for most of the suffering in this world. The girl was going over her global studies homework, in the air where she drew the map with her finger, touching the Gobi Desert, the plateau of Tiber in front of her, and looking through her transparent map backwards, I did suddenly see how her left is my right, and for a moment I understood. You didn't like this one.
Not necessarily. I wrote down my thoughts.
Great. Do you want to share them?
Sure.
You don't have to.
Yes, I do.
You don't have to.
Force at gunpoint. No one can see the gun.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't really understand what the failure of love has to do with seeing the map in different ways. Love is a concept only made concrete by the words and actions we attribute to it. To say love has failed is to absolve oneself of personal responsibility. There is suffering in the world because people have failed others, not because some ideal is not borne fruit. If one can't understand that, then it's unsurprising that a child needs to show that everybody sees the world differently. The girl's comprehension, on the other hand, is her success, not love's.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll read mine real fast. Failure of love might account for most of the suffering in the world. Shifting perspectives and sifting through stories in life, one tries to see things from the shoes of another. Developing this asset of openness and empathy, seeking that elusive understanding that always seems to come in surprising moments, when you least expect it. For it seems that there is strife getting from point A to point B in your day-to-day life, and completing to-do lists, paying bills, keeping up with the shows, and all of that. And then wham, you encounter an image, perhaps of children, perhaps refugees, perhaps hurt and afraid, perhaps happy. And you are sucked into a vortex, you know, perhaps life is so much bigger than you will allow it to be. And then the timer goes off on the coffee maker and the kids are going to be late for school. And perhaps later you can carve out the time and resources to care. Perhaps later you can cultivate those connections of understanding. Perhaps you are the one who will connect the dots. Zing.
Nice.
Thank you.
Now let's talk to John S. Hall.
Hi, this is John S. Hall, and I'm on page 125 of the book How to Make White People Laugh, and I have not begun my song yet. I usually like to read the book all the way through at least once. Sometimes I take notes while I'm doing it, and then I go back to those pages, or sometimes I read the book a second time. And I only got the book last week, so I haven't had that much time with it. But I get some sort of general feeling that I'll write something political again, because the book has a lot of politics in it. I was interested in one quote, the Martin Luther King quote on page 63, something about, you know, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. I thought that was a good quote, and I thought I might be able to build some sort of song around the idea, the importance of speaking up, especially when you're around people who you're generally comfortable with, but they say something that you're uncomfortable with. I feel like that's a good time to say something. Those kind of interactions, I feel like, can have some impact. I'm generally skeptical of the idea of changing minds, but what you can do is inspire people who are somewhat on your side to be more committed, or people who are motivated to be more motivated. So I don't know if the song will address that or some other topic, but I'm always a little uncomfortable when I have any kind of deadline or anything hanging over my head, but I am aware that if I don't have a deadline, often things don't get done at all. So better to have one than not. It gives me some sense of purpose. And the only other emotion, I don't know if it's an emotion or a thought or something, but I saw that Ray Brown had posted that he had finished his song already. And I guess I was initially jealous, but then mostly since I read that a couple of days ago, I've been just sort of more inspired and motivated to get mine moving.
Going to an interview with Swan Dusty.
This is Swan. I am currently on page 104 of Negin Farsad's book, How to Make White People Laugh. I hope I said her name right. I started this book a couple months ago and then worked on it more a couple months ago, and now I'm still working on it. I had to browse through the first half and remember how great it was. So my thing is still definitely in its conception phase. I'm trying to decide who I'm hoping to collaborate with on the book, and that will help shape what my thing is. It could be a poem or a film clip or a song. So basically it could still be anything, and anything could happen. I am procrastinating because I do that. That's why deadlines are nice. So this check-in has definitely inspired some motivation and action, and that's cool. As far as my feelings about the book, I've been laughing a lot, but also been aroused by some of the different parts of the book. I love the tone that Negin has. It's just like a most mockumentary book, but also very real and authentic. I'm curious to see what's going to happen next. So we've talked a little bit about obstacles. Sometimes when you're making a film, obstacle is not having the right resources or money. As a writer, sometimes the obstacle is like maybe a lack of information or time to write or experience. But I also find that there's some more subtle obstacles of maybe like running out of motivation or inspiration. Or for me, my issue is perfectionism of just being like, it's not perfect yet. It's not ready. Have you encountered obstacles in your work, and how do you overcome them, Chris?
As far as the perfectionism one, I just kind of throw it out the window.
Yeah, that's probably for the best.
Yeah. I mean, not that I want my work to be sloppy per se, but just that like, if you want it to be perfect, I mean, hypothetically, you could work on it ad nauseum and just never be done. So, I don't know. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that your work has reached a certain level of quality and just to be done with it.
Call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're a painter, you got to stop painting before the paint becomes muddy.
Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it.
So that's something I struggle with. And like when I notice that I'm getting into those like spiraling thoughts of like, oh, it's not good enough, I just tell myself done is better than perfect. It's a stupid mantra, but it helps me feel better. Of like, oh, okay, well. And I love also, I mean, if you didn't catch the first show with Susan, her creative process, step one is giving herself permission to write the worst song in the history of all the songs that have ever been written, and then go from there. Nice. So just giving yourself permission to make crappy stuff sometimes.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you'll have to start somewhere. If you never make anything, then you'll never make anything good.
Right. And if you make 10 things, then maybe one of them will be good.
Yeah.
Or maybe 10 of them will be good. And one of them will be great.
Maybe zero will.
Or maybe none of them will.
But that's fine too.
And you'll have fun making them.
Yeah, that's not a... It's all... I mean, at the end of the day, if you've created something, I think there's still something that... There's a lot to be said for that. Even if it's not particularly good.
What about issues of motivation?
I mean, mine tend to be mostly practical ones. But I don't know. I just kind of do it. I know that's not really a great answer as far as helping others, but yeah, I don't know. If I have things that need to get done, then I just want to get them done. And so I just do it.
It's like the Nike logo.
Yeah. And that works,
you know,
out
that's
well.
A good mantra too. Just do it.
Yeah.
I try to think when I'm feeling unmotivated, I think usually there's two kinds. There's like the, oh, I have so much more to do demotivation of like, oh, I've been working so hard and I still have so much to do.
Yeah.
And that one's just like you said, you just kind of like keep grinding, keep going forward. And the other one is though, like a lack of confidence and, or just like, oh, maybe I can't do this. And I just do it works for that too. But for me, having like a secret bag of compliments or like a little treasure chest of like things that people have said to you that were encouraging at the time. Or maybe having like a friend that you can be like, hey, can you remind me that I can do this? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's silly, but it helps to have this community of people that think that you can do something that you don't think you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of great artists in different mediums have massive egos, because to some extent, especially if you don't necessarily have that supportive community, that is kind of what you do need.
Like self-bolster.
Yeah. You need to be like, I'm amazing, and so I can do this.
And then the last challenge is the inspiration. Do you ever feel like you have a fallow period with your creativity, and like, what do you use to jumpstart new ideas?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that I deal with in my work, because, you know, I produce videos for a living, and which is hard because you have to like be creative regularly on a deadline and within certain set parameters. I mean, I think the biggest thing a lot of times is just like getting out of my office. I love being outside, so I think even just going for a walk can help. In a larger sense, I mean, I love traveling, so taking a trip, I always feel, definitely revitalizes me. So yeah, and you think that, I mean, the going for that walk outside is, I guess, is a mini trip, if you will.
Yeah, no, and I think, I mean, having read a number of books on the creative process, like going for a walk is like always one of the first few suggestions. Oh, not feeling creative? Go for a walk.
Yeah.
Like, go see nature, go see people. And then as a writer, you never really know where ideas are coming from, but sometimes something will strike you. So like maybe you're in the grocery store and someone says something and like it like sparks something. So just getting out and about in the world where things are unexpected and anything can happen can sometimes just like get different ideas and different paths going in your mind. And then other things, I give myself permission to take a break, which maybe isn't good, maybe is, I don't know. If I am like stuck, I don't have an idea, I'm like, okay, I'm going to walk away from this, I'm going to do this other thing, and then I'm going to come back to it. And so just like, and I know that that's a thing too, of just like giving something space to breathe, and then you can kind of go in and fill it out some more.
Yeah, I think as long as you have the discipline to return when you step away, that's a big thing.
I do.
Oh, great.
I feel like I said, you know, giving something time to breathe, because I feel like that's something with a song too. Sometimes you like is this, I've heard musicians say, you know, you make the song and then you revisit it and then kind of just like, it's like fostering a friendship, maybe, you know, like getting to know it better and be like, oh, I like that about you. I just learned it.
Yeah. It's definitely gives you that new perspective or just an altered perspective.
Mm. Nice.
Talking about Bushwick Book Club with Ray Brown.
All right. We're here talking with Ray Brown, singer-songwriter. You want to say that your name is Ray Brown?
Yes, my name is Ray Brown.
Will you confirm that for me?
Yes, yes.
Because these people may not believe me. If I
Ray
just
Brown,
say.
I'm not the bass player. My dad is James Brown, though. I mean, his name is James Brown.
That's awesome. Okay, Ray.
Yes?
All right. You've been writing songs for how long?
6 years.
Okay. And you've done book club just how many events?
I've written one song for book club. I've performed at book club accompanying John twice.
Okay. And how fun has it been writing for book club?
It's so much fun. It's the most fun. It's a different form of songwriting for me, so it's really fun. I'm being real. It is really fun because it's a different form of songwriting. And
how different is it for you from your normal songwriting?
It's completely different. And I sing different also.
Explain.
Well, I noticed that the reason I know it is because I was singing my new song in my kitchen yesterday, and I thought, this sounds exactly like the other song I wrote for Bushwick Book Club. I'm using this voice that I never use in my other songs.
You've developed a whole new voice for book club songs?
Yes, yes.
Incredible. And how would you describe that voice?
Talking conversationally.
It's more conversational than usual.
Yeah. And a lot more words.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm just trying to say more in the amount of time. There's a lot of words and it's hard to memorize. And I want to have it memorized by the 8th because I don't want to have a piece of paper in front of me.
Tell me about the process of writing this particular book club song.
I was leafing through the book and watching YouTube videos of Negan and jotting down ideas that came to me on my iPhone.
Did the ideas come fast?
They came very fast. And then when I went to sing the song, it was just exactly as I had written it. I didn't change anything.
Wow.
So it's kind of random. Kind of doesn't make any sense. But it makes sense to me, and it would make sense to anyone who had read the book. And I think Negan will hear things that probably nobody else in book club will hear because she will understand them.
And did the music come soon after the words, or did it all come at the same time?
It came all at the same time. That's how I always write. I just started playing guitar and singing what I'd written on my iPhone, and it just came out.
Perfect. And when did this happen?
Two or three days ago,
yeah. Just like that.
And then yesterday I was going over trying to memorize it and trying to concrete it, set it in stone.
Are you excited about the show?
Yes, I'm very excited.
All right, great. Will you join us for a post-show interview as well?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much, Ray.
Thank you, Susan.
That's it. I think that's it.
Yeah.
That's really incredible,
Well, that's the thing when I write songs. Do you ever have this? I need another verse. I need another verse for the song.
Yeah.
And then I do this weird thing when I realize the song is done, and then I start laughing. I always do that.
The laughter accompanies the birth of every new song?
Yes. When I realize it's done and I don't need any more, that's ridiculous. The song is done.
And then you laugh. And
then I just start laughing.
That's how you know that the songwriting process is complete in Ray Brown's world.
Yes.
That's awesome. What a great signal of completion.
Laughter. Does anyone remember laughter?
Oh, I love you, Ray.
I love you too, Susan.
That's what a girl wants to hear.
I love you more than
That's
you love me.
That's the right answer.
Hey, Thomas Wolfe, how you doing?
Was great. Thanks for being here, Chris, and I'm so grateful.
My pleasure.
Oh, Chris is pleasured to have been here, and So much thanks to Susan and to everyone who contributed a clip, Casey, Jesse, Gia, Jim, John, Ray, me, and Thomas. This was Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Make sure you check out our online community. And I'll leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Madrigal. Madrigal.
Madrigal.
The Tin Man sitting in the waiting room with his brand new plastic heart. He don't know where to start. Can't really tell it's a false alarm, 'cause he can't feel much of anything. No, he's hollow to the core, and what he pours inside don't satisfy. Spills out on the floor. The doc comes in 20 minutes late, and he pours himself a drink. He says, boy, I ain't no shrink, but you better watch what it is you think, 'cause that thing that ticks inside of you has got a mind of its soul. It'll drive you mad for what you never had, make you burn like black coal. Cause he came up strong with too much love. But all he knows from films, and he follows the actor's lead. He's jammed a rose between his teeth and scrubbed his armor clean. And he's running up and down the avenue, his joints are creaking in the rain. He's made a date, but she never came. Now of course he has gone insane, and he shouts her name into the night, startles the passers-by. And on the road not far ahead, she hears and she takes a fright. And he came up strong with too much love, a cold hand to hold. You better hold him down till the end of the show. And when they danced, he broke her back with the weight of the world. You better hold him down till the end of the show. Yeah, you better hold him down until the end of the show. Police report had a note in it, made the captain blush. Thought it all was a little much. He didn't know they called it love. It seemed the Tin Man screamed some profanities from the top of a city bus. When he caught a sight of his girl inside, he slipped and died for all of us.